Hello, everyone. We're glad you found us, and welcome to our podcast at antiqueauctionforum.com. We hope you find this show entertaining and informative.
This is Martin and Rain today, and guess what? Rain's not my co-host, or I'm not her co-host. I'm actually going to be asking her some questions. We're going to try something new here, and we're going to have an informational show. And since Rain has such an expertise in art glass, that's what we're going to talk about. How are you doing, Rain?
Pretty good. You mean we're going to talk about glass, and I'm going to be interviewed like I'm somebody special?
That's right. How do you feel about that?
I'm not sure. I'll tell you how I feel when it's all said and done.
Okay. All right. Now, haven't you written some books? Or you've done a lot of articles and things on art glass over the years. You're known for art glass.
I am. I have written lots of articles, and I've been interviewed numerous times. And I did write a book on art glass for the Dayton Art Museum in Dayton, Ohio. On their collection that goes everything from Roman glass all the way to contemporary. So I kind of wrote the history of glass making, the different periods of different glass that was made, and then featured, you know, little blurbs about every single piece that they have. They really have a beautiful, beautiful collection if you've never been there.
So I know that Lewis Comfort Tiffany was very interested in Roman glass, and that's what inspired him to create his glass. Were there any other makers ahead of that besides the Romans that were making iridescent glass before Tiffany?
Well, actually, that's kind of an interesting question, and I've always found it's one to be kind of interesting. What a lot of people don't realize is that Lotz was making iridescent glass before Louis Comfort Tiffany was. A lot of people have
I had no idea.
Yeah. You know, you hear all kinds of stories, you know, that Lotz worked for Tiffany. That's not true. That Lotz was inspired by Tiffany. That's not true. I think it's plain to
see.
He's
Czech, right?
Yes, correct. He's Bohemian. Mm-hmm. And
Bohemian, uh-huh.
I think that it's very easy to see that they both influenced each other in some of their designs, and that nature was a huge influence in their designs. But they both did some similar designs of each other's. But the Lotz company was actually making iridescent glass before Tiffany's company was. So a lot of times I've heard Tiffany collectors say, you know, and I'd say, well, do you like Lotz glass? Do you, you know, have any interest in Steuben glass? And people have said to me over the years, oh, Lotz, that Tiffany wannabe. You know, and I kind of sit and scratch my head and just kind of smile and say, you know, okay. So the answer to your question is yes, there were.
Okay. So now I know, I believe I read somewhere that didn't Lotz only sign glass for like 3 years or a year or something like that, and most of the pieces are unsigned. Is that right?
That's true. Most of the pieces are unsigned. I'm not sure how many years they actually signed, and they signed their glass a handful of different ways, so there wasn't just one way. But most Lotz glass was indeed unsigned.
I have seen pieces of Lotz that had fake LCT signatures on them. I'm sure you've seen that too.
I've seen that. I've seen pieces of Lotz glass with fake Lotz signatures on them. It's kind of funny, but a lot of times pieces that are unsigned, you know, people have felt like, well, if we put a signature on it, it'll make it easier to sell. And I guess for the novice who still hasn't been able to tell a piece of glass by looking at it without looking at the signature, you know, it would influence them in which to buy it. But to a true Lotz collector, they don't necessarily want something with a fake signature on it, even though the piece, you know, is what the signature purports it to be. Also, I mean, there's some collectors that if it has a fake signature on it, they'll pay to have it removed. So,
wow.
Yeah.
They have it ground and polished.
Yeah, they'll have it ground and polished out.
Yeah.
I've seen Tiffany pieces with Steuben signatures, Steuben pieces with Tiffany signatures. It's also incestuous.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
It
Do you know when Tiffany started to make this kind of iridescent glass?
I think in the early 1890s all the way until the early 1930s. So for a good period of time.
Uh-huh. So right near his death, he was still creating it. Now, what was the extent of, do you know what the extent of his participation was? In other words, did he work directly with his glass blowers?
Tiffany did. He did not blow glass himself, but he oversaw things. And he was, you know, known for, you know, walking through the studios looking at different things. And if he thought something was less than it should be, it's purported that it would be broken by him and ask them to start over. And, do it again. And in many instances, his level of perfectionism kind of kept the company in the negative. And, you know, it's been said that had he not had the kind of money from the family that he had, he probably would have failed, even though his glass is, you know, his glass and his lamps and his windows is what it is. I mean, he was quite the perfectionist, and he would have something redone and redone. And there aren't very many other glass artists from that time period that you could say the same thing about. I mean, they certainly liked producing good product, but if something was less than perfect, it still would oftentimes find its way onto the market.
So if you see a Tiffany vase and it has some type of flaw in it, most likely it's not correct, I would assume.
Well, that's not necessarily true either. But what would happen is perhaps, you know, it was one of the artists that worked there, or somebody who worked for the company, would take it home at night. And that's how it would disappear off the shelves and eventually make it, you know, to the market.
I do believe that I have handled an Aurine vase one time that had a little bubble in it, and I was quite surprised. Everything else about it did look perfect.
Yeah, and there were pieces. Some of the techniques that he did would have issues with the cooling process, and sometimes you would have internal cracks. Because of when it would cool down, there would be, you know, something in the glass that would cause it, even the smallest things, if it was a piece of ash or something that would make the glass unstable and crack, or just from the way that the glass was made, the chemical compound that was made was unstable itself, would cause a piece to crack. And obviously, if it was something that was caught, it would not be sold, but if it wasn't caught, if it got past them, then yeah. So you will find pieces with in the making, as we like to say, imperfections. But it's not as often as some of the other companies.
Uh-huh. Now, getting back to when he started, wasn't he involved in an exhibition where his pieces became real popular?
The Paris Exposition of 1900?
Yes. I believe that's what it is, yes.
Yes, and he was fortunate enough to, you know, his father had stores around the country and in other countries as well, and so his items could be, you know, exhibited in his father's stores, which were, you know, fancy, good, well-to-do, you know, for the wealthy type of stores. So that was an easy way to get his products in front of, you know, the right type of people.
Right. Do you know if his art glass became popular right away, or did it take a while?
It's my understanding that it did very well right out of the gate, and it's interesting because some of the earlier pieces are not as strong in color, not as great in decoration, though collectors oftentimes covet those early pieces because it's something. Sometimes there are forms that you just didn't continue to see, shapes that you didn't continue to see, decorations you didn't see, you know, very often, and you know, even while they're not necessarily as commercial as some of the more popular things are, they're a little more unique. And mm-hmm. you know, the diehard collectors seem to really like them. It's kind of like Steuben glass. The Steuben glass collectors, they tend to like the early, what we call the three-digit pieces. And those were glass that had some of the earliest pieces that were made that had three-digit signatures, like numbers on the bottom that were only in three digits that signified it was an earlier piece, and the color of the glass, like in Steuben, had not quite been perfected yet. The Aurines, back in the three-digit numbers, they tend to be a more silvery iridescence as opposed to that kind of garish, real brassy gold that they managed to create later on down the line. So you kind of see the same kind of thing going on between the two different houses for the earlier pieces.
You know, a lot of people think of Steuben glass as clear glass, but I'll tell you, there's some fabulous pieces that were made in Aurine and the pearl color. I can't remember what that's called. But they demand very high prices for the rare pieces.
Absolutely.
Almost as high as Tiffany.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, at one point in time, Louis Comfort Tiffany went to sue Frederick Carter and Steuben for, you know, for supposedly stealing their chemical, you know, recipe, if you will. And then the lawsuit was dropped, and I'm not really sure what kind of happened in between to make that happen, to make it kind of just go away, but it did.
Now, when you said earlier that he probably was running his company in a negative because he was so fussy, did he ever have trouble keeping up with the production of the demand of his pieces?
I don't think that he had problems keeping up with the demand, you know, but he was one of those kinds of people that, you know, his level of perfectionism, he would kind of take to the extreme. He was a very smart businessman. I mean, even for his level of kind of anal, if you will, a lot of people have had, you know, kind of conversations back and forth between the numbering systems on the bottom of Tiffany, for example, and some people believe them to be shape numbers. And in instances like the pastel lines, it's kind of been proven that they're shape numbers. But the earlier pieces have numbers, and people thought that that was either a dating system, whether it was a K prefix, or, I mean, a letter prefix or a letter suffix would indicate about the time period of the year that it was made. And then other people have felt like it was an inventory number. And I think the inventory number amongst some of the longer-term dealers is something that they kind of think actually might be the case, because you will sometimes see a number that's been scratched out, more than one number. And it Tiffany was known for putting things in stores on consignment. So unlike today, like if a store wants to acquire a product, you know, they buy it and maybe they pay for it in 60 days, 90 days, whatever it may be, the product comes first. And as far as Tiffany went, he would put his items in the stores, and if they hadn't sold in 3 months, they would be withdrawn from the store, because he didn't want people to continue to see the same thing sitting on the shelf again and again and again that would lend to Tiffany's products having fallen out of favor. And he definitely didn't want that. So they would be picked up and returned and then put at another store another time, which actually might explain why there would be two different sets of numbers on the bottom of a piece.
Speaking of numbers, but the numbers on the metalwares and things like that, did they indicate a model?
Yes, correct. Something you're talking about, like a number on the bottom of a base for a lamp.
Right.
Right, and also on the shade of a lamp as well. And yeah, and the great thing is, if you have the book Tiffany at Auction by Alistair Duncan, he took the time at one point to put those numbers in order and address a photo to go with each number, so you could look at that number and then kind of go back to finding on what page, you know, that shape number was, that base number was, that, you know, whatever, and you could go look and see if it matched what it was that you were looking at. And that, it's not true, there's not a photo for every single number that's in there, but for a good portion of them, the things that you do see kind of again and again. So I know that many of us have taken that, and if somebody called on the phone and said, well, I have, you know, for example, a 16-inch tulip shade on, you know, base number, blah, 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 without looking at a photo, you could pick up the book, flip to the back, find that base number, look at the photo, and you'd know immediately what it was that they had for sale.
I know that he signed, getting back to Art Glass, he signed his Art Glass several different ways, LCT, Favril, Louis Comfort Tiffany. Do you know why he signed those Art Glass pieces so many different ways?
Well, and they were also signed LC Tiffany Favril, LC Tiffany Favril Inc. Some were signed with paper label. There was more than one kind of paper label. The paper label sometimes would come with an inscribed number and a paper label, so that explains why sometimes you only find something with a number and not a, like an LCT or anything like that. Those are traditionally earlier pieces. And, you know, I mean, when you buy something today, don't you take the kind of sticker off of it when you buy it? I mean,
yeah,
so it's,
right.
Yeah. It's something that's 100 years old.
Made
I'm sure
in China.
It's been washed and cleaned at least once or twice over the last 100 years, you know, since the item was made. So a lot of those paper labels did not last. You know, different, like whether something was a paper label or a signature, some of that just indicates the time period in which they were made. You know,
right.
Why he would use LCT on some things, and then LC Tiffany Favril on others, LC Tiffany Favril Inc., LCT Favril. I mean, the variety, I don't really know why one was used and not the other. And I don't know if it boiled down to whoever it was in the finishing department, because when pieces were made, they would go to the finishing department until they were sold. When they were sold, then they would be signed. And I don't know. So they could sit on the shelf for a long time and not be sold, signed, finished. You know, but until they were going to be shipped off or until somebody came in and bought them, you know, they didn't have a signature attached to them.
Something my father told me when I was pretty young, about 15 or 16, when he was showing me a Tiffany vase, is he said, you take your thumb and you rub it along the signature, and if you can just barely feel it, it's probably right because it's a diamond point signature. But the fake signatures were sometimes used a Dremel or some type of vibrating thing,
Dremel
and you
tool.
Really feel the fake signatures. Is that true?
You know, I've actually never heard that, and but I would imagine there probably is some truth to that. I've never, kind of rubbed my finger over it before. I think, for me, when I've looked at the signature on the bottom, whether it's right or not, is just more about, you know, looking at having looked at numerous signatures and also, again, looking at the piece itself and determining,
right.
You know, is it right or is it not. You know, it's kind of like a painting. You know, the signature part is the easiest part of the whole thing. The last thing, you know, that should be the last thing you look at and not the first thing. But in many people's cases, it is the first thing. But, you're probably right. There probably is some truth to how that feels. I can't say I've ever rubbed my thumb over it, though. I'm going to have to try that on a fake piece next time.
Well, my father didn't always tell me 100% correct information, but he did tell me what you just said. Never go by the signature of a painting. Never go by the signature on a piece. Go by the piece first and how you feel when you're looking at it.
A lot of times when people ask me, well, how is it signed? And I say, how would you like for it to be signed? You know, don't let that, and essentially it doesn't mean I'm out signing pieces, because Lord knows I'm not, but it's more about trying to teach somebody, don't let that be the defining point for why you do or do not acquire something.
Well, we talked about Lotes earlier. When did some of the other copycats begin? I know there was Quizzell, and there were some other companies. Can you talk a little bit about them and when they started?
You know, again, at the turn of the century, Quizzell, Steuben, Durand, Kubla, Trevace, there were a number of them, you know, basically on the East Coast. And what would happen is in some instances, you would have glass blowers or designers from Tiffany that would jump ship and think that they could make a name for themselves or take their designs from Tiffany and make them somewhere else at another studio. And you have the same problem in the Bohemia region. You know, there were a lot of, again, the whole incestuous thing, people that worked at one factory and then left and took their designs and made the same one somewhere else. And until you really get to know the glass, sometimes it does make it challenging. You know, where was this made? And it again... You know, the forms are the same, the decoration is the same, but the color is just a little bit off, just a little bit different. And, you started to see, around the turn of the century, as Louis Glass success became more and more prominent, more and more, people trying to do their own thing and trying to compete with him. And some did it somewhat successfully. Nobody really as well as he, but some that have certainly made a name for themselves, and I think what's helped kind of keep collectors interested in the smaller, companies is a couple of things. One, we certainly had some very talented artists producing glass, no matter which factory they were working for. But the other thing is as Tiffany's fame kind of came back into favor, after it fell out of favor, and then, Lillian Nassau and she kind of helped create that market again. Tiffany glass got so expensive that a lot of people who really enjoyed that kind of glass just flat out couldn't afford it or couldn't justify it. And so here were these other glass houses that were affordable, not as well known, and you could have something that was period, not a reproduction, not contemporary, that you could add to your collection that was, almost just as nice, and for, a fraction of the price. But, much like, other leaded lamp manufacturers that were creating things, You know, everything, there's no interest in something, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of interest in something, and so that, you know, raises the demands, the whole supply and demand thing, raises demand for it, and all of a sudden the price goes up. So what once was affordable all of a sudden kind of became expensive.
We were talking about fake signatures a little bit earlier, and if you had to guess, would you think that there's more fake Tiffany glass out there than real Tiffany glass?
No, I don't. I mean, there's certainly a lot. And what's interesting is that not all of it is really fake Tiffany glass. I mean, I don't think there's really a whole lot of fake Tiffany glass that's out there. It's more glassware like, you know, Phoenix Studios or Orient and Flume, you know, California Lumberg Studios, glass that was made to stand on its own merit. And there's just the naughty people that are out there that take off the Lumberg or the Phoenix or the Orient and Flume stickers, signatures or whatever, and put a fake Tiffany signature on there. So I think you see actually more of that than actual reproduction glass, because it didn't start out as a reproduction. It started out as, you know,
Lumberg is actually selling fairly well these days. I've seen it sell anywhere in California. It's pretty well sought after.
Look at Charles Lawton. Charles Lawton is probably, you know, as far as any of the iridescent glass that's made on, you know, the contemporary American market, is probably the most expensive. I mean, more so than Lumberg or any of the others. Charles Lawton stuff has quite a following.
Okay. Now, what would you tell a novice collector on how to carefully collect, say, Tiffany right now?
Well, you know, what I tell anybody, first and foremost, is buy what appeals to you. You know, if somebody tells you something's rare, if you don't like it, don't buy it, whether it's rare or not. You know, I can appreciate wanting to have a piece to have as an example, even though you don't really care for it. Okay. But for the most part, build your collection by things that make you smile, things you like. And once you've figured out, okay, I like Tiffany glass and I only like gold decorated pieces, or I only like floriforms, or I only like Cypriot, whatever it may be, you know, that you narrow it down to they made that you like, figure out what your budget is and then buy the best example that budget will allot you. It's not smart to have 10 pieces of gold plain Tiffany. You know, take the amount of money that you spent on the 10 pieces and buy, if you happen to like the gold, then buy a gold decorated piece of Tiffany. Buy the one piece or two pieces as opposed to 10. Does that make sense?
Good advice.
When you're buying things that are, you know, the middle level to the higher end level, you'll never go wrong. The lower end stuff that's a dime a dozen, it's never really going to amount to much of anything in your lifetime, you know, or in its, you know, I mean, it's great to have 5 finger bowls and 6 sherbets, but are you really going to use them? Why not have one really pretty vase to put in the, you know, in the middle of your fireplace mantle or in the china cabinet under a nice light and you know, have something you can really show off.
Right. Now, I saw at auction one time a red Tiffany vase go, and it went for a ton of money. I know there's some really rare pieces. What is your experience with some of the rare pieces? Have you come across a lot of them?
It's interesting that you say rare, because at one point in time, kind of before eBay, and you know, there's many people selling things on the internet, it was thought to be that red Tiffany was rare. We kind of know better now.
Really?
Yeah, you know how it is. You've been in the auction business long enough. All it takes is for one, you know, special painting, or that somebody thinks that it's special, to show up and hit a big price, and
exactly,
all of a sudden there's 10 of them next week up for sale.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what happened with the red thing. You know, so red is, I mean, it's nice to have a piece of red Tiffany in your collection, but I would recommend a decorated red Tiffany piece in your collection before just a plain red. You know, I've sold some great glass over the years. I've sold pieces of Tiffany glass. I think the least expensive I've ever, I mean, the most expensive I've ever sold a piece for was $85,000. And I know that, you know, colleagues of mine have sold pieces for considerably more money than that.
Wow. As far as a collector getting into collecting Tiffany, let's say art glass vases, what might they get in the door at as far as spending for, say, a little small vase or something like that?
If you're looking at a piece of Tiffany, a gold piece of, you know, a gold simple piece of Tiffany, you know, but unless there's something unique to it, you can start buying Tiffany vases for under $1,000 all day long.
Are you a collector yourself?
I am. I've been a collector. That's what prompted me to become a dealer. I was a collector for a couple of years before I actually rolled over and, you know, started playing dealer. I actually became a dealer so I could fund my own personal collection, which a lot of us kind of went down the same path. Not really with the intention of being a dealer, but that's kind of where you ended up purely by accident.
I've heard that many times from people and all that collect all different kinds of things that become dealers.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about eBay and buying online. Is that a place known to have some good pieces of Tiffany glass?
Over the years, some interesting things have certainly shown up. We used to see more interesting Tiffany several years ago than we do today. The dealers have kind of shied away from listing too much inventory on there because for one problem or another, you know, deadbeat bidders, people who are just, you know, bidding on things and then they don't pay for them. They're just raising the price up and then at the last minute withdraw their bids. I mean, it's, you know, it's like the wild, wild west on eBay. You know, and I think another thing is a lot of people have shied away from buying things on eBay because they can't hold them in hand. And what my interpretation of excellent condition is may not be the same as yours. And that doesn't mean I'm out to defraud anybody. You know, just maybe I don't mind there's a small scratch on the bottom of the foot. You know, maybe I don't know to look with a really powerful light to see that it's got an internal crack. And then when the person gets it and they see that it's cracked, well, was it cracked to start out with or did it get damaged in shipping and it's a lot of money to tie up to try, you know what I'm saying? So we used to see a lot more good things show up there. And I know every great once in a while something still does, but I know that I don't see and hear the stories about greatness showing up there all that much anymore. But you know, the second you air this, there'll be something rare that shows up there and it will be called something that it's not. And somebody's going to get it for a bargain and I'm going to be laughed at.
Right, right. Now, I know you mentioned Lily Nassau earlier. And I know that all Tiffany pieces basically fell out of favor in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And when did people start collecting again? Do you know?
Well, what's interesting is that Lillian decided that, you know, she, in the 60s, she decided that she was going to create a market for Tiffany again. And she and a few other dealers would go into Sotheby's, which was Park Bernay at the time, and Christie's, and they would go and bid against each other. Box lots of Tiffany used to come up for sale and was just given away. And so they decided that they would create this, what gave the appearance of, you know, battle in which to, you know, to have these things. And so they were just kind of bidding against each other back and forth, creating, you know, the illusion, you know, that this was back in demand. And then they would buy the things and take them into their stores and sell them. So people would come to their stores and see these things and they had seen, you know, kind of the what gave the appearance of strength at the auction market. And so they felt like it was something that they should buy. So it's kind of a funny thing back in, you know, back in the 60s. And, you know, I've been told that, you know, back in the 50s, you could buy a box lot of Tiffany glass for, you know, $40 or $50. Gosh, why couldn't I have lived back then and know what I know today?
Jeez. Yeah, no kidding. Wow. It is such a limited resource. What do you think the future of values will be? Do you think, this is kind of a two-part question, do you think it's ever possible for it to fall out of favor again?
You know, I think that the Tiffany name, even if you're not a collector, you pretty much know the name. And you equate it to glass or lamps or windows. And I think people always kind of equate it with the affluent as well. And you see enough of it in magazines. You, as long as the auction houses are selling it, you know, that kind of shows that there's a reason to collect it. You know, a lot of times people look to the auction houses to tell people what they should buy, what's popular, and how much they should pay. Mm-hmm. And so as long as you still see it in the museums, as long as it's, you know, still written about in books, and as long as the auction houses are still carrying it, I don't think it'll ever fall out of favor. It hasn't really ever fallen out of favor since it kind of came back into favor. I mean, we've certainly had times where The Japanese came in and they were buying up, you know, everything to build museums and paying large amounts of money for things. And so what gave the appearance of, you know, it rising at a much stronger pace than normal, and then all of a sudden it went kind of quiet. It never really went kind of quiet. It just went back to where the market should have been all along. You know, so, I mean, it's always kind of continued to steadily rise, you know, every year. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't think so.
Right. Now, Steuben Glass, still in business in upper state New York, do they ever create anything like the old creations, or do they just strictly stay to clear glass at this point?
Well, they actually made clear glass back in the day as well. And so the answer to your question is, are they making colored glass? I haven't seen them make, and I don't really follow the newer designs so much. I think that they're still doing clear crystal. And there was a time not long ago, and gosh, I hope this doesn't happen to be the case, but there had been some talk about Steuben Glass having their glass made somewhere else, like abroad. And that's, that's disheartening. And, I was contacted by somebody the other day that the, Steuben has a store in New York City. And, I found it very interesting. This gentleman invited me to come out for a personal tour of the Steuben store. And he is a sports memorabilia dealer. And, and he's had, an exhibit of sports memorabilia within the Steuben store for 2 or 3 showings now. They're looking for a third extension or a fourth extension. And I thought it was great, but then it kind of made me ask, you know, myself, why would Steuben have, what's the relationship? How is this benefiting them? And so I'm not really sure if that's a sign of the times or, you know, or if they have found a way to make a marriage between Steuben Glass and sports memorabilia, which, it's piqued my curiosity. So if the exhibit is still going on the next time I'm in New York, I'm definitely going to go check it out. Yeah.
Right.
But I believe that they're still not doing colored glass. And I can tell you that their store in New York for at least a while, I'm not sure if they still are or not, because I haven't been in there in a little bit, but a few years ago they were starting to sell antique glass. So, you know, Frederick Carter era glass, not just the contemporary. Mm. And the prices were that they were putting on these things were for the year 10,000. I don't know if they ever got it, and maybe they did just from tourists, people who didn't know any better, but there was no collector that was going to go in that store and pay the kind of money that they were asking for things. It was really over the top outrageous. But it was good to see that they were at least exhibiting some really great, you know, pieces in the store.
Mm-hmm. But I do remember the first time that we spoke, you told me about an incredible appraisal you did not too far away from the Steuben company. Can you talk about that? The woman had 800 pieces, was it?
Oh, well, I have a client. I had a client, she's passed away, who had over 5,000 pieces in her collection.
That's what it is.
Yeah, she had over 800. Is not such a big deal when you're talking 5,000. 800 is a lot for me, but
right.
5,000 was overwhelming. And I can tell you that the story you remember was she lived in upstate New York as a child, and her family was very well to do, and each of the children was to determine what their job, their profession was going to be by the time they were 13 years old. And she decided she was going to make one wing of their house into a museum. And she wanted to show in her museum Steuben and Tiffany and other glass. She also had a penchant for Victorian glass and things. And the family was so well-to-do that Steuben would close in the evenings and allow her to come in like Michael Jackson, you know, on a clothing spree, go in and shop. And she would acquire things. And she was in her 80s by the time I met her. And she was still collecting to that day. And she had an amazing, amazing, amazing collection. But it all started, just as you remember, from her visits to Corning. Yeah.
She probably collected 800 items in her sleep.
It was very interesting. She had I can't remember if it was 200 or 300 épergnes, different, every single one of
them. Oh, my God. Those can take up a lot of room, and they're fragile, too.
That's right. And somebody at the time, there wasn't really a book out on Epergnes, and I kept telling her that was something that she really, you know, should consider partnering up with somebody because, I mean, they were each unique. They were wonderful and not my kind of thing that I collect, but I'm telling you, to see that many of these out on display, I mean, they weren't boxed away. They were out on display. And it was unbelievable to see.
You said she passed away. Any ideas? The collection, has that gone somewhere?
I don't know what her family didn't really care anything about the collection, you know, because they had kind of grown up with it, and it owned her. She did not own the collection. The collection
mm-hmm.
owned her.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that has 5,000 anything is owned by their collection. And
right.
I had, at one point, had a museum come in with me who was interested in acquiring the collection. And as I had mentioned, you know, her family was very well-to-do, and that continued on throughout her years. And we had offered several $1 million to acquire her collection, and they would put it on exhibit permanently at the museum and, you know, and put her name on the collection. And it just goes to show, it was interesting that she had us come out a couple of times to look at the collection, but that she really had no interest in selling it, even though she said she did. Because we have a museum that wants to do all these, and museums don't normally buy, as you well know. You know, they don't normally, especially that volume.
Save the benefactor.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of the last that I spoke with her, and I know that her husband had passed away, and she wasn't too far behind. So I don't really know what's happened to it to this day, sadly.
Yeah.
Imagine it probably rolled through some auction houses would be my guess. Her kids probably wanted to clear it out of the house as quickly as they could and call it a day.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever seen Portland glass?
Sure, yeah. Like a Portland vase?
Yeah.
I
did an auction one time for a guy that had 5,000 pieces of Portland glass. He wrote the book on several books on Portland glass. And out of all those 5,000 pieces, he had, say, a handful that had some serious value that were unusual, you know, colored pieces and things like that. This was before the clear glass market dropped drastically.
Yeah.
So we sold right at the right time, but you can imagine how many days it took us to move with a big crew.
Oof.
To pack and move all that stuff to an auction hall. It was really amazing. Never want to do that again.
No, I can totally imagine because I had to inventory this person's collection, photograph and handwrite and measure every single piece. Which is what I was hired to do before reaching out to the museum. And that was a very long, I mean, it was me, myself, and I. That was tedious.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
That appraisal must look like the phone book when you got done with it.
It did. It most certainly did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Rain, I think we're out of time. I want to thank you so much. This has been a pleasure doing this together.
It's been very unique. Next time I'm going to interview you.
Yes. Okay, sounds good. Okay, so you'll hear from both of us soon in another upcoming podcast. So this is Martin Willis with Rain Haynes, and we're signing off.